This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices All-Stars Episode 72 was recorded on October 21st, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. All-Star Jeff Snyder is back. Mr. Eurodollar joins us again. Jeff, the Fed is buying U.S. government debt, thereby quantitatively adding to the size of their balance sheet. But we're being asked to believe that it's not quantitative easing. Okay, whatever. Ever since the middle of September, though, the central bank has been doing something. There have been overnight repo operations, term repos, and now this so-called small-scale asset purchase program, which, because it's small-scale, that's only $60 billion with a B dollars per month, we're asked to believe that it's not QE somehow. And that follows another adjustment to IOER, and what was, I believe, the first adjustment to the reverse repo rate floor. There's a lot of moving pieces here, a lot going on, which already proposes more than your regular garden variety of fine-tuning. Oh, and the repo rate just jumped again last week, pulling Fed funds up with it. So, Jeff, I'm looking over your slides, and I can already tell that we're about to get another lesson in modern money in true Eurodollar University style. I'm hoping that will begin to piece together what's going on here, because, frankly, a lot of us are confused about it, and there don't seem to be many good answers, or solutions for that matter.
Yeah, Eric, we spent the last few podcasts talking about the other side of things, you know, the bond side or where collateral is in the repo market. And given the way the repo market still isn't behaving and how so many people, including those at the Fed, have focused instead on bank reserves, I thought it might help if we zeroed in on that part today. You know, it's completely understandable why there would be both the attention on bank reserves as well as, you know, continued misinterpretation of what they might actually represent in the real world, in the real sense. In conventional terms, bank reserves are a form of base money. That's what we're told from the very beginning. If the Federal Reserve possesses the monetary printing press, then what comes out of it at the other end, as far as monetary policy is concerned, is bank reserves. These are even included in the monetary statistics, right, as part of M1, and therefore the other M's that build up on M1. So it seems pretty safe to conclude that bank reserves must be money. They must be the base part of the money supply. That's how they are, you know, literally classified by everyone from monetary authorities to economists to the entirety of the financial media. So if you believe all that, then when the Fed begins reducing the level of bank reserves, so-called quantitative tightening or QT, you know, you would think that would lead to system tightening and all the kind of stuff that we've seen over the last year and a half. So if more reserves is printing, then fewer reserves must be the opposite. And that's why supposedly banks are having trouble filling the demand for repo and Fed funds. The Fed, you know, it just went too far with QT, and that supposedly left the system with not enough excess reserves.
Right. That's the mainstream explanation that gets cited pretty much everywhere when talking about the repo imbalance and Fed funds. On one hand, people have said too many treasuries raise demand, and on the other hand, not enough bank reserves are limited supply. As you said, you already covered the treasury side, treasury auctions and what prices are saying about them and so forth in previous podcasts. But why wouldn't bank reserves be a compelling explanation as far as supply?
Even though we're talking about complex, sophisticated markets, what we're really discussing are some very basic concepts, you know, like defining what counts as money itself. What do we mean when we say liquidity? It's really just fundamental currency elasticity. You know, over the years, especially after the Great Depression, it became common to focus on elasticity as purely a public function, which has been handed over to the monetary authorities and central banks, and that obviously for our own good. And elasticity is simply the ease at which someone will create currency and distribute it when it is in demand. So in the case of any monetary crisis, elasticity is exclusively attributed to a central bank function, you know, the lender of last resource. We never think about the currency itself. You know, what currency is it that needs to be elastic? We obviously are not talking about the Federal Reserve notes, physical Federal Reserve notes, and certainly not bricks of gold bullion. If some monetary medium needs this elasticity, what exactly is that medium? So if we start on slide 3, if you say that medium does not include the Fed's bank reserves, people look at you funny, even though it's really not that difficult to provide a general basis for that proposition. We've all been taught that the Fed does money exclusively, you know, so don't even bother looking into the subject. Yeah, if you go back quite far in time, what you'll see is a tremendous monetary evolution, which a very long time ago was a much more public discussion, a much more public topic of discussion, even among central bankers and authorities. Currency and elasticity are on the one hand basic concepts, but not so straightforward in this modern framework.
Jeff, I see that you've highlighted on slide 4 that the idea of M1 being obsolete was part of the official discussion all the way back in 1974. And that just opens the door, right? If M1 was becoming a problem because it was outdated all the way back in 1974, well, that's 45 years during which a lot of things could have changed.
Yeah, and changed again and changed again and changed maybe 5 more times since then. You know, the basic proposition is this. By the 1970s, authorities could no longer define money with any degree of accuracy and certainty. You know, that's a problem even in the best of times. But in the context of the Great Inflation, you can kind of understand how there was some urgency to the matter. You know, something wasn't right in the monetary system, which was causing all sorts of havoc in the real economy. Going on to slide 5, you know, quite a few of the economists and authorities went looking to see if they could find out what it was that they were missing on the money side. But yeah, you know, all they found was that money itself was missing, except it wasn't really missing. Rather, the traditional definitions of money were not keeping up with how especially the banking system was evolving in the way in which it was doing business. Harvard economist Stephen Goldfeld was one, you know, on slide 6 in 1976. He was the one who coined the phrase missing money, and he approached it from the conventional perspective of money demand.
Money demand, that was when old school central bankers used to try to navigate monetary policy by forecasting how much money the economy would need in order for the central bank to set their goals and targets. And then they would try to match that demand so that big imbalances wouldn't happen either way, too much or too little money.
Yeah, exactly. You know, how much money the economy needed. And what Goldfeld found by the middle 70s on slide 7 was that the Fed kept forecasting the demand for money or demand for the money in the economy and the banking system. And they thought it would need X amount of reserves and dollars, you know, the stuff that gets included in M1. But that in reality, the system only demanded a fraction of what was being forecast. And the reason was the banking system kept coming up with new ways of doing monetary things. New sorts of bank liabilities that met all the functional requirements of being a monetary medium. In other words, the money wasn't really missing, at least not as far as banks and the economy was concerned. It was only missing in the sense that authorities couldn't keep up with what banks were doing, including these new forms, you know, things like repo, as a matter of fact, that remained outside of their limited monetary definitions.
That does seem like it could be a pretty big problem. After all, a central bank is supposed to be first and foremost a bank. If it's not really a bank in the same way as other banks are being banks, then maybe it's not going to end up being central.
Yeah, and that's just what kept many central bankers, most especially Alan Greenspan in the 90s, you know, that's what kept them up at night. If you go to slide 8, they knew they had lost the ability to track money in this new modern system and lost it a long time ago. And we haven't really touched on it here, but not only did the monetary evolution spread out vertically into all these different forms, it also spread horizontally all over the world. That's the Eurodollar part of it, you know, a global system where currency within it was being defined by the banks themselves outside of both traditional definitions as well as geographic boundaries. So what Alan Greenspan was actually saying, even during his most famous Irrational Exuberance speech, was that since we can no longer define modern money, how in the world would anyone know if something like the stock market was behaving rationally or irrationally? You know, he tried to cover that by claiming economists had developed new techniques of monitoring the economy and the important factors about the economy. But the point remained, you know, central bankers had lost the ability to track, monitor, and even define money in what was an increasingly globalized monetary system.
Okay, so getting back to the idea of currency elasticity then, the implication here isn't just on the side of maybe there's too much money and that could lead to something like the housing bubble. There's also the other side to think about, right? What could happen if there ever came a time when there was too little of this other kind of currency? Which brings up the question, where did the money come from to create these global credit bubbles?
And that's really my point here. We won't be able to talk about the specific detail. We don't really have the time to go over that. You know, about what exactly were these financial liabilities that became monetary or, you know, part of the monetary system. You know, what those proliferation of products actually were, as Alan Greenspan said in June of 2000. For now, all we need to focus on is that it wasn't the Fed which was providing the money behind the bubbles. In fact, as you can see clearly on slide 9, the level of bank reserves was falling all throughout the 1990s and middle 2000s. There were practically no bank reserves because the banking system, this global Eurodollar system, transacted in a currency that was called dollars, and it was denominated that way, but the banking system didn't need those bank reserves. It created its own kinds of currencies, with virtual currency, ledger money, this proliferation of products, as Greenspan said. You know, these had things that had created bank liabilities that were the actual money supply, and that was the liquidity. So long as banks were willing and to engage in these very esoteric and complex activities, that's where the liquidity and elasticity would come from without any need for the Fed in its version of bank reserves. And so there are practically none, even though during that whole period, the biggest asset bubbles in history just seemed to show up. And so let's put our chart, go to slide 10. Let's put our chart on bank reserves into a more appropriate scale. In addition to these bubbles, foreigners, suddenly began piling up huge holdings of U.S. dollar assets, while their local monetary systems became flush with what sure seemed like dollars. The whole world was dollarized during this period, especially China. It was a global monetary explosion that happened outside of the Federal Reserve's view and outside of its intellectual framework. And that's why there was never more than a pittance in bank reserves. But what central bankers like Alan Greenspan led you to believe was that it didn't matter. The Fed didn't need to know all these details. It didn't need to define the proliferation of products because they would just fly above it all and control everything via the one single lever, which was just moving the federal funds target around a little bit here and there. And they expected that would influence bank behavior and that the banks would sort out all of those complex and difficult details.
Which obviously was a pretty big flaw in the design. Let the banks handle the details, and officials would just assume that they could handle the banks. And when the time came, I know from Eurodollar University, they found out it wasn't quite so simple and easy to handle the banks. In fact, as you've said before, they couldn't find a way to plug back into the system, which in a nutshell was the global financial crisis.
Yeah, right. Again, it's the concept of currency elasticity. You go to slide 11. When the time came and there proved to be too little of this modern liquidity and currency, what the Fed did was attempt to be lender of last resort through its various emergency liquidity programs, calling them liquidity. But the end result was that it offered these anachronistic bank reserves. And we talked about this before, back when we were discussing Fed funds and repo before the middle of September, going over those ceilings and floors, it led to one of the most ridiculous but poignant aspects of the global crisis. During the worst part of it, late September 2008, through to the middle of March 2009, the Fed claims there was abundance of bank reserves during that time. And there was, except that the abundance of bank reserves didn't mean what it was supposed to mean. It didn't mean that the Fed added liquidity because bank reserves don't count as liquidity in this other system. Certainly not to this highly evolved, bank-centered monetary system that spans the entire globe. So there were abundant reserves, sure, but still a huge and devastating shortage of liquidity in the functional and effective in the monetary system. So therefore, bank reserves couldn't have counted as effective liquidity. They don't tell you anything about it. But because, M1 went way up, because every single article written in the mainstream media says QE was money printing, that's what the public has been led to believe. And it doesn't matter how long inflation goes missing or how the global economy has never recovered from what was a true monetary event, that missing elasticity, bank reserves continue to be thought about as money just as the way the Fed wants it.
Okay, so let's fast forward to today. What you're saying is that if quantitative easing wasn't actually easing, and easing is supposed to mean a more elastic and liquid monetary system, then quantitative tightening was what?
Yeah, so we go back to what everybody's talking about now, that the Fed is normalizing its balance sheet, unwinding those QEs, the level of bank reserves has declined, to which I say, so what? I mean, that was always the plan. From the very beginning, even the Fed has been counting on this other liquidity, that pre-crisis proliferation of products to step back in. I mean, that was the whole point of QT. Slide 12 here. It wasn't really tightening. It was the Fed saying that the system had finally healed enough that the central bank would take a step back and let that private system take back over. Never mind that the Fed never really stepped in. Even these guys who don't know a damn thing about this private monetary system were counting on that private monetary system to provide elasticity going forward. And if that private system was at all in as good a shape as they kept saying, no one would have noticed QT at all. The level of bank reserves would have dwindled down to a much lower level, and the Fed would have gone back to flying above it all, just moving the federal funds range around, believing that the healthy private banking system would effectively and predictably sort out all the messy monetary details. But that just didn't happen because, you know, not knowing much or anything about these details, the Fed made a really crucial error. From Ben Bernanke to Janet Yellen to Jay Powell, they all keep saying that the financial system has recovered, but it's pretty clear over the last decade that it hasn't. All the market and liquidity indications you and I keep talking about, we keep going over, you know, in our podcast together, we keep citing that show these intermittent what are really dollar shortages.
And Jeff, a dollar shortage is just money inelasticity, correct? That's the banking or financial system demanding currency, whatever form that might be, and being unable to find enough of it that it doesn't start to produce problems. Problems like the repo rate going haywire on an otherwise nondescript September afternoon.
Yeah, right, Eric. Go to slide 13. The problem cannot be the level of bank reserves, because the only thing that the level of bank reserves tells us is what the Fed is doing. It tells us nothing about what the private liquidity system is doing. And it is the private liquidity system which matters. We go to slides 14 and 15. Where is all the liquidity and shadow money that the private system used to provide in overabundance? Where did all of that stuff go? Why didn't it ever come back? That's what's missing the past few years. And it isn't bank reserves. It is that other stuff. It is the proliferation of products that stopped proliferating in August of 2007. You know, that's the real currency. And there's no one who can or will amp up its elasticity. There's no one willing or able to provide that liquidity, regardless of the level of bank reserves. And that takes us right back to the question you and I have been discussing all throughout the last couple of years. Where are the dealers? You go slide 16. When we talked about Fed funds and IOER, you know, those ceilings and floors, again, those markets and the relationship to the ceilings and floors, those were telling us long before September that the dealers had already become unusually shy. They were increasingly absent, and it is the dealers who create that liquidity, and that's where any elasticity would come from, not the Fed. It's showing up because that dealer system, this highly evolved global credit-based monetary system, simply has never been fixed. The financial system has never healed from the crisis.
Jeff, I think this is the single point here. The crux of everything I've learned from you with Eurodollar University and since has been that the bankers had tricks up their sleeves. They knew how to create global dollar liquidity. They stopped doing that at some point, and it's completely unclear to me why they stopped doing that. So the Fed is just going back to doing the only thing the Fed knows how to do, which is it increases the level of bank reserves, hoping that that's going to help, when in reality, it was never really the Fed that used to provide all of the needed liquidity. It was the dealers through this mechanism of the creation of offshore euro dollars. They've stopped doing that. And I guess the thing that really I just can't figure out here, Jeff, is why did they stop doing that? They made money doing that. So we're being asked to believe that bankers are leaving free money on the table because they've already got enough money and they don't want more. I don't think that's it. So what's going on here is the dealers are asleep at the switch. The Fed's trying to do what the Fed knows how to do. It's not helping. Is that essentially what's going on here?
Yeah, in a nutshell, that's what happened since the middle of September, too. We go to slide 17. We've seen it coming, going all the way back to the earliest weeks of 2018. And then it finally broke out into the public consciousness, which forced the Fed into these repo operations. And now it's not QE, small-scale asset purchase program, all to increase the level of bank reserves, even though they won't have any effect on liquidity. There's no elasticity. There's no tangible results from them. You know, and again, going back to your point, bank reserves simply are not base money. And so we ask, where are the dealers? Why aren't the dealers willing to go back into these money dealing behavior and that money dealing activity? And the answer is, it's simple risk and return. You mentioned that there's opportunity there, and there is, but we also have to consider the other side of the equation, which is the risk of taking on these activities. Before August of 2007, it was widely perceived that no matter what you did, there was no risk to it and tremendous upside. In fact, there was only upside. And that kind of asymmetry fed into the rapid growth of the private system outside of the Fed's purview. And why wouldn't it? Because if everybody believed you could make nothing but tons of money doing all of these money dealing activities, everybody's going to flood into those activities. And that's what happened. You know, the mantra was you got bigger, and it didn't matter how you got bigger or what you did to get bigger. The banking system just grew and grew and grew because everybody thought there was no risk to it. all upside, no downside. Well, ever since really Bear Stearns went belly up, or nearly went belly up, the banking system has learned a pretty powerful lesson that, hey, you know what? There is a downside, and there is a tremendous downside to these kinds of activities. And so, yeah, there might be some profit opportunity in some of these spreads that open up when we notice that the dealers are absent in these money markets. But overall, they're still aware of the risks. So maybe there's a little bit of an opportunity when the repo rate gets into double digits. But yet, you know, the bankers inside of this monetary system realize and know that there's also risks to undertaking it. And what they're saying by leaving those what we think of as fat profits on the table, what they're actually saying to you is that we think the risks of going in and chasing that arbitrage are too much for us to go in and chase that arbitrage. And so they're perceiving that the risk, and mostly liquidity risk, because bank reserves are not money, because the Fed really doesn't add liquidity to the system, the liquidity risk is much higher than maybe you and I perceive than what is actually the case in the system. So there's a risk return imbalance that's been flipped upside down completely. The asymmetry is all against the system now. Where it used to be all upside, no downside, the banking system is telling you that it perceives mostly downside and very little upside. So that's why we keep asking, where are the dealers? Where are the bankers? Is that they perceive that, you know, in this broken system, in this broken economy, it's all risk with very little return.
Well, it seems to me like maybe what's going on, Jeff, is the Fed has literally replaced that asymmetric, low-risk, high-return trade for the dealers with a better one. If you look at, you know, when the system is working because the dealers are doing their thing, there is some risk to that business. But if they let the system break to where the Fed has to intervene, it creates this opportunity for the dealers to front run the Fed. And they always make money doing that. So could it be that they're just happier letting the system stay broken so that the Fed is constantly trying to rescue it, because that gives them an even better asymmetry of risk and reward?
I don't think I would agree with that at all. And the word I don't agree with is better. Banking system obviously does not make more money under this way than it did under the other way. Banks have shrunk over the last 12 years. You know, contrary to popular perception that views Wall Street a certain way, it has not been a good time to be a banker over the last dozen years. In fact, it's been completely horrible to be a banker over the last dozen years. Obviously, they still get paid. Obviously, they still get their stock options. But bank balance sheets have shrunk. It's very hard to make money as a global bank, and especially in the way that we need the system to need bankers to make money. Talk about the core bond trading concepts, which is where you would think if they're making a ton of money, a ton of profits front running central banks, that's where it would all show up. But in FICC in particular, what you see is the exact opposite. FICC revenue has declined and declined and declined and declined. And it's gotten to the point where there's no money in money. So banks don't do it. You know, they're getting along. Maybe to put it most terribly, they're getting along with, you know, getting paid IOER. They're getting along a little bit front running what central banks are doing under quantitative easing. But to think that they're doing better now than they were doing before, I don't think that's the case at all. And I think if you actually ask them and they were honest in their answer, they would tell you, hey, we'd love to go back to the way it was before because we were the kings of the entire world. And so, you know, but how do you go back to that? How do you get back to that kind of a system when everybody realizes that it was an unstable system to begin with? And that's really what we're talking about here, is that as much as it seemed to work, it never really did. It was always an inherently risky proposition, as you pointed out, Eric, that, you know, once it became apparent that it was risky, then there's no way to get the toothpaste back in the tube.
Well, Jeff, I can't thank you enough for another fantastic Eurodollar update in today's All-Stars appearance. We look forward to getting you back in a couple of weeks for another update. Listeners, stay tuned to your Macro Voices feed. We've got Professor Steve Keen and Diego Paria coming up this week. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.